Saddle up your horses.
Well, welcome everyone to Red Sky Radio Program, the Robin Walter Show here on the Red Sky Radio Network. Thank you for tuning in today. I just want to encourage before we get started today for people to listen to Sunday Morning with Robin Walter. I've got a really, I feel like, a God-directed message. I mean, I guess if it wasn't God-directed or I didn't sense that, I wouldn't give it because that means I'm sharing out of my own wisdom, which doesn't amount to much. But it's a program entitled Picking Up a Dog by the Ears. I think you'll find a lot of takeaways in the Sunday Morning with Robin Walter program for this week. Next of all, is that the right one? If you want to reach me, you may, certainly at redskyradio777@gmail.com, redskyradio777@gmail.com. And I want to just let you know that for those of, I haven't said this for a long time, but it seems like maybe I should today, that I can be reached, or the program can be obtained various ways through virtually any podcast that you might have. If you're on Rumble, you would type in Robin Walter Show, all one word. You'll pull up two images, one with a Bible and my glasses, and that is the ministry program, Sunday Morning with Robin Walter. And the one where it's just my mugshot and a cowboy hat, that is this show, the Robin Walter Show with Red Sky Radio. So there's two ways to Rumble. You got to make a choice once you go in, but you go in with Robin Walter's show. And I think maybe you can get into a Sunday Morning with Robin Walter also. On all the other podcasts, you just type in the name of the program that you want, one or the other. I haven't shared that in a long time, but it's a little bit confusing, and we can never quite figure out why we can't separate them on Rumble, but we can't. But anyway, Rumble's a good site. And so we are going to launch here today. I've got something that I want to share that maybe it's the good, the bad, the ugly. The old Clint Eastwood movie from, goodness sakes, does that date me? That goes back a long ways. People ask me if I saw that movie, and my answer would be, I don't know. I don't remember. That was so far back, I can't even tell you whether I did see that movie or not, and with probably about 50 other movies. But anyway, the good, the bad, the ugly. Well, we're going to start in a different order here. I think I'm going to start with the ugly, and then we'll get to the good, and then the bad. Gosh, I'd hate to end with that. No, I don't want to. You know what? I'm changing the name of the program right now. Forget it. I don't have a name for it. Let's just get rolling. The good news here is that we have a life other than this life, right? For those of you who've accepted Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, this isn't it. Now, the Lord wants to see us do what we're called to do, right? When we're all done, we want to hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in a few things. I will make you faithful over many things. That's what we want to hear. So, in this life, the issue is not whether we succeed in the task ahead of us. It's whether we are faithful in approaching and taking on the task. And there is a difference. Are you going to be faithful? And I always go back to Ezekiel when I make this point, that God says to Ezekiel, I think in Ezekiel 2, verse 8, thereabouts, eat what I give you, Ezekiel. I've got a task for you, and you do it. And if you don't do what I'm telling you, then you're actually engaged in sin just as much as the other people are engaged in sin for their behavior and their activities, which actually you aren't doing. You're not honoring false gods. You're not worshiping idols. You're not committing adultery. You're not committing sodomy. And you're not offering up children to the gods Molech and Ashtoreth, all those patently obvious manifest evils. But Zeke, if you don't do what I tell you to do, you're actually just as disobedient as all those people that are doing those other things. And God managed his expectations. So they're not going to hear you. They'll make fun. They'll hear you, but they won't listen to you in the sense of taking it to heart. They're going to make fun of you, and they won't change your ways. But I need a man on this earth to tell it like it is, so that when I come to judge Israel, they are without excuse. And that's why when somebody says to me, who do you sort of fashion yourself after? Who do you think you're the most like in Scripture? I say, well, gosh, I'd like to say, one of the disciples and things, but it comes down to Ezekiel. And with a strong dash of Jeremiah. The Old Testament guys who were not well liked because they bore the hard truth. That's my calling. That's a horse I got to ride on. That's why you hear what you hear. But we do have some good news in here. And the good news today is that this isn't it. This is just a preface to eternity. And if you think of it that way, I mean, the tribulations that we endure, it is a short period of time, right? They're little. They're small compared to what Paul said, the glory that awaits us. So it's sort of like, and I cannot relate to this at all, other than philosophically, the relatively brief period of pain that a woman goes through delivering a baby, compared to the hours, days, weeks, months, and years of joy that follows. How's that for making an analogy for something I know absolutely nothing about? But I've witnessed it. I guess I know it by observation. So with that, keep in mind, whatever you do today that you're called by God to do, you do, and you rejoice in good results, and you rejoice if there are no good results, but you simply are thankful to God that you did what you're supposed to do. And you move on to the next day, you move on to the next person. I'm not going to spend my whole life praying for just a certain person if it detracts from engaging with others. I'm not that focused. Paul moved on. They wouldn't hear his word. He hit the road and went to another city. And we are to do the same. Okay. I actually should have said the good, the bad, and the insane. But I think I'm just going to have the good and the insane today. But before I get to my first piece, I want to share one other thing, and that is I decided at the beginning of the year I was going to try to broaden the topics that we covered on this program. I will tell you, the listenership, both the podcast and the terrestrial station that we're on, has fallen off some, and I know why. I know because not only was Trump elected, but Trump actually lived to the inauguration. We see the things that he's doing, and we kind of have the Ronald Reagan syndrome here a little bit. Okay, all right, we got him in. Now it's up to him, and I can see what Elon Musk is doing, and maybe the prayer life falls back a little bit on praying for our leaders. We think they have it in control. We're in good shape now. We can go on to do some other things. And the earnest of prayer diminishes when the threat is removed. I mean, you know that. I know that. I go in immediate prayer when I'm caught up in turbulence on an airplane. I hate turbulence. I hate it, hate it, hate it. I'm not a great flyer. It doesn't take much to turn into white knuckle for me, and I will immediately begin praying as Jesus prayed for the waves of the sea to cease and desist. I pray and take authority over the waves of the air that they cease and desist. And as And there's been marvelous results, not because I've always been working in complete faith. But I say that I have faith, but God help, I believe, but help my unbelief. So, but what happens to that prayer when the all of a sudden the skies are calm? Well, the threat's removed. The prayer seems to go away. I'm not praying for a continued smooth flight. I go back to my magazine or whatever I'm writing or whatever I'm doing. It is natural. I sense that happening. There's an optimism in this country from a business standpoint, although I don't know if I'm going to get to it, but I'm going to talk about one of the things Trump is doing terribly and horribly wrong, which we'll get to. That's going to be kind of the ugly. This is the insane, then we're going to go to the good, and then we're going to kind of go to what he's doing wrong. But, well, let's just get going. All right, talking about insane, the state of New Jersey. The state of New Jersey is just gone nuts. They have gone off the deep end. They have a form that forces parents to declare at the time their baby is born. Talking about women giving birth and the pain goes away. Well, maybe the pain won't go away quite as quickly as it normally would when the mom and the dad have to fill out the forms in a New Jersey hospital about the baby's gender identity and sexual orientation. And they have choices as to what the baby is. Male, female, cisgender, whatever. I don't even know what cisgender means. Binary, all this garbage and crap. Transgender is an option. The state forces the parents when the child is born to tell the state whether the kid's a tranny and he's 5 days old. The poor kid hasn't been circumcised yet. Maybe. I mean, some they circumcise right away, some they circumcise on the 8th day by the, you know, Judaic law. So is this the first? Well, I don't even want to get into it. It sucks so badly. New Jersey, you suck. And I mean it. I can't be nice about a state that is so screwed up as to force parents into a gender decision at birth. These are the people that call out, talk about being pro-choice, right? Tell me, pray tell, what choice does the child have? Not jack squat crap diddly. No choice at all. That doesn't mean if they put him down as tranny or a he-male, she, whatever. The choices, I don't even want to go through the list. There's about 8 choices you got. And then, of course, because Democrats are in control in New Jersey, they will be adding to the choices because, as I've said before, to Republicans, there are only 2 genders, male and female. All the others have been invented by Democrats. Oh, my goodness sakes. All right. The next thing I'm going to touch on, but I'm going to go into much greater depth down the road here. You heard me for probably ad nauseum for the last year and a half, well, for a full year before the election, and then some. My worst fear, my greatest fear, was that Gavin Newsom would end up the candidate. I predicted that he would be, and I was wrong. I was thrilled that I was wrong, but I have never backed off from the fact that if he's not there in 2024, he will be there in 2028. The guy has all the makings of the new Democrat. New, meaning reimagined himself. And how? Well, he has all the things that concern me. He is handsome, well-dressed, charismatic, well-spoken, but he's also slick. He's a charlatan. He's a liar. He's a deceiver. He is pure and raw evil. And the only time I would ever vote for Gavin Newsom is if we actually had a chance to vote for who should be the Antichrist. He's that bad. He is awful. He is the worst person on the political landscape in America presently and for the last 10 years. He will be the candidate, and I hope J.D. Vance is up to the task, because I'm concerned that there's a lot of women who will just be drooling in their armchairs over, I don't know, some kind of a relationship with this guy, and he'll have the JFK effect, right? Younger and middle-aged women put JFK in because they liked his hair and his good looks and all of that. And that's maybe why it was, Adam disobeyed, but Eve was deceived. And that's my concern. And it gets worse because he's got This Is Gavin Newsom, his podcast. And you know that he funded, it just came out this morning, Gavin Newsom was behind the funding and personally put in money to create a bust of himself that sits in the Sacramento airport. This guy is a narcissist of all time. And the only reason he doesn't have the full plate of activities scheduled is because of the amount of time he spends in front of the mirror. And honestly, I don't believe that there's global warming. But if I did, I would consider that the carbon footprint with Newsom with all the axle grease in his hair is part of the problem. Am I jealous? No. This guy is evil. He's always been evil. He's, talk about coming in on a silver plate, the nephew of Nancy Pelosi. The guy has everything to appeal to the flesh. In other words, he will be a modern day Saul. But what compounds this is he's inviting people onto his program, like Charlie Kirk. All right. Steve Bannon is on it. He's inviting conservatives. So why? So that he can look like he's coming back to the middle, that all of a sudden he is now kind of anti-tranny, because he knows he can't get a sorry butt elected if he's pro-tranny, even though his wife sits on the board of pro-transgender organizations. He's a liar, a deceiver, a cheat, a charismatic charlatan. I've said it for a year and a half, and I will keep saying it. He will be the undoing of America if he's elected, and my gut sense is that he may well be. Okay, enough about that turkey. Now, to something I want to share that is, I think, is really good, and I am going to read it. It's long. Sit back and enjoy this. This is not something I could put together. It's put together by EKO. Actually written about a month ago, and I've been wanting to share it, but other stories keep eclipsing it, and it's entitled Override, Inside the Revolution, Rewiring American Power. So Override, hyphen EKO, I don't have the name of the person who actually authored this, but that's as much credit as I can give. I validated this through other sources, and I just have to read it to you for you to get the full impact of one of the most incredible things Trump has done. And then we're going to finish, frankly, with what he's doing wrong. And it's not too late to fix it, but he's going to have to fix it fast. Are we going to have some problems? But under Override, it said, titled, The Clock Struck 2 a.m. on January 21st, 2025. Here we go, and I quote, in Treasury's basement, fluorescent lights hummed above four young coders. Their screens cast blue light across government-issued desks, illuminating energy drink cans and agency badges. As their algorithms crawled through decades of payment data, one number kept growing: 17 billion in redundant programs and counting. We're in, messaged Akash Baba to his team. We're into all of it, his quote. Now, I have to stop. These four young coders, I think it expanded to seven after this. These are young, ridiculously smart brainiacs that Elon Musk brought in. In other words, people kind of like Elon. Edward Korestein's code had already mapped out three subsystems. Luke Ferritor's algorithms were tracing payment flows across agencies. Ethan Shoatran's analysis revealed patterns that career officials didn't even know existed. By dawn, they would understand more about Treasury's operations and people who had worked there for decades. This wasn't a hack. It wasn't a breach. It was an authorized disruption. And while career bureaucrats prepared orientation packets and welcome memos, DOJ's team was already deep inside the payment systems. No committees, no approvals, no red tape, just four coders with unprecedented access and algorithms ready to run. Quote, "The beautiful thing about the payment systems," noted a transitional official watching their screens, "is that they don't lie. You can spin policy all day long, but money leaves a trail," end quote. But continuing on with the overall quote, "That trail led to staggering discoveries. Programs marked as independent revealed coordinated funding schemes. Grants labeled as humanitarian aid showed curious detours through complex networks. Black budgets, once shrouded in secrecy, began to unravel through algorithmic scrutiny. By 6 a.m., Treasury's career officials began arriving for work. They found systems that thought impenetrable had already been mapped, networks they believed hidden already exposed, power structures built over decades but revealed in hours, their traditional defenses of slow-walking decisions, leaking damaging stories, stonewalling requests proved useless against an opponent moving faster than their systems could react. By the time they drafted their first memo objecting to this breach, three more systems had already been mapped. Pull this thread," said one of the senior officials watching over it, had warned, watching patterns emerge across DOJ's screens. "Pull this thread and the whole sweater will unravel." And he wasn't wrong. But he misunderstood something crucial. That was exactly the point. This wasn't just another transition. This just wasn't another reform effort. This was the start of something unprecedented, a revolution powered by preparation and presidential will combined with technological precision. The storm had arrived. Treasury was just the beginning. For decades, personnel is policy. That was the principle articulated by conservative strategist Troop Hemmerway. It remained more theory than practice. Previous administrations spent months, even years, trying to staff key positions. But Trump's first term saw barely 100 political appointees confirmed by February of 2017. Every delay meant another victory for the permanent bureaucracy. This time was different. While media focused on campaign rallies and political theater, a quiet army was being assembled. In offices across D.C., veteran strategists mapped the administrative strategy's pressure points. Think tanks developed action plans for every agency. Policy institutes trained rapid deployment teams. Former appointees shared battlefield intelligence from previous administrations' failures. By Inauguration Day, over 1,000 pre-vetted personnel stood ready, each armed with clear objectives, mapped legal authorities, direct lines to support networks. For this wasn't just about staffing. It was a battle plan decades in the making. Quoting J.D. Vance, "This is the new normal." Speaking about Trump, and he's having the time of his life. Referring to the president's relentless drive, "We've done more in 2 weeks than others have done in multiple years." The secret, however, wasn't just speed, it was precision. Instead of waiting for Senate confirmations, the transition team prioritized non-Senate confirmed positions. Now, I have to step in here and say something. This was something that I actually mentioned before I ever read this, that the key to Trump's getting behind the dark veil of secrecy here was to appoint the real bulldogs to positions that did not require Senate approval. Yes, you have the right person as cabinet position, but then you start appointing a people underneath that person who doesn't need cabinet positions. Then that cabinet official gives that person authority, and they go at it like a bulldog, an attack dog. And that's what they have done. It was why Matt Gaetz did not need to be the head of DOJ. There was maybe a spot for Matt Gaetz, but some place where he could be appointed without Senate approval, then turn Matt free. Let him go at it. So let me backtrack just a little bit and reread the last sentence, because I don't want to lose the context. And I won't be able to finish this before the break. The secret wasn't just speed. It was precision. Instead of waiting for Senate confirmations, the transition team prioritized non-Senate confirmed positions. While Democrats prepared for traditional confirmation battles over cabinet posts, an army of aligned personnel was already moving into place. Strategic positions were identified, legal authorities were mapped, support networks were established. The president reminded his team daily, "We don't have," I'm quoting President Trump, "we don't have a lot of time. 4 years is a lot of time in political life, but it's not a long time in real life," end quote. Spoken by a man of his age, he would know. You got to move fast. Got to beat them to the punch. The urgency drove innovation. When DOJ's young coders breached Treasury's payment systems, pre-positioned legal teams neutralized resistance within hours. When career officials tried revoking system access, they discovered that DOJ's authority came from levels that they could not challenge or stop. When leaks surfaced, rapid response units fed counter-narratives to alternative media instantly. Continuing here with a quote from Vance again, "When you look at the people surrounding the president, we're trying to make it easy for him to do what he wants to do in government. When you have the team and the entire team firing on all cylinders, you can get a lot done," end quote. The permanent bureaucracy never saw it coming. They were prepared for resistance. They were ready for protests. They had plans for leaks. They had plans for legal challenges. But they had no defense against an opponent who had spent years preparing for this moment. Now I have to insert something here. And I have said this multiple times, but it's worth saying again. Why did Trump have years to prepare for this moment? Because he did not win in 2020. No. It's why the loss in 2020 was a blessing to him and a gift to the rest of America. Time for him to realize what he had done wrong, who he had picked wrong for the positions, which were most of them, who he could trust, who he could not. He could identify all the people who were not going to be supportive by the ones taking pot shots because they thought they could do it with impunity because they never figured he could possibly be at the top of the ticket in 2024, whether it's Chris Christie, whether it's Nikki Haley, all the people he could no longer trust that he thought he once could. They came out of the weeds, the bushes, the rocks, and from behind the trees to attack him. And now he was able not only to, he already knew his enemies, but now he could identify the enemies that he thought were friends and said and realized the deep state is way, way deeper than I ever thought it to be, and I have to prepare now. Trump has been preparing in his four off years, not just campaigning. You think it's all about rallies? He loves rallies, don't get me wrong. But all of this was in place or being put in place in preparation for a moment the likes of which we've never seen in government, and maybe never will. Well, that's not the end of my comments. Well, maybe it is, but it's not the end of what I have to share. I've got a lot more. Just don't go away. Robin Walter with The Robin Walter Show. We'll be right back.
The Robin Walter Show is a listener-supported program. Your contribution goes to help as many people as possible to hear that the Word of God has answers to help you survive and even thrive in the dark days ahead in this country. We pledge to bring you the critical information you need to make informed decisions in this age where big tech and big media have conspired to rid our country of everything Christian. Please send your support to Red Sky Radio, P.O. Box 99, Wickenburg, Arizona, 85358. That's Red Sky Radio, P.O. Box 99, Wickenburg, Arizona, 85358. Thank you.
Hey, I still love that song. It was, I think, the first record I ever bought. And I still got it. I bought it for a buck, and it's got to be worth at least a buck and a quarter these days. I don't know. Okay, back to the override. And if you've missed the program up till now, please get it on the internet, your podcast access to hear it. And I'm going to back up a couple of sentences so I can maintain the continuity here. That here we're talking about the Treasury Department and DOGE's coders that have gone and threw in with their algorithmic-based computers and following the money trails and uncovering years of secrecy, dark money, you name it. And I want to go back a couple sentences with stating here that the permanent bureaucracy never saw this coming. They were prepared for resistance. They were ready for protest. They had plans for leaks. They had plans for legal challenges, but they had no defense against an opponent who had spent years preparing for this moment, which, as I said, was a blessing in disguise that none of us saw for Trump not winning in 2020, because it gave him 4 years to figure out what needed to be done, smart man that he is, assemble the people necessary, 4 years to do it, to finish the job that he never would have been able to finish had he been elected in 2020. So continuing, this wasn't just about filling seats in a bureaucracy of Trump's team. It was about building a machine designed to transform American governance. Every position mattered. Every appointment carried weight. And behind it all stood a president counting down not years or months, but weeks and days, driving his team forward with a relentless energy. The foundation was set, and the revolution was just beginning. And I have to interject here again that I cannot overstate the importance of the entrance of Elon Musk into the world of Donald Trump. Now, it may be that Musk was far more connected earlier on. Trump and Musk were connected much earlier on than what we know from public disclosure and what Musk said when it was time to come out, because he couldn't do what he was doing entirely behind a veil of secrecy inside the Trump. I don't know. Maybe we will never know. If Elon writes a book someday after the Trump presidency is over and he is no longer an influence, I want to tell you, I can't even imagine what a bestseller that book will be, even by those who hate him, who used to love him, but now they hate him and they're burning Teslas. Okay, what was next? It spread. It spread from the Department of Treasury to USAID. USAID fell next. No midnight raids this time, like the Department of Treasury. No secret algorithms, just a simple memo on agency letterhead stating, quote, pursuant to executive authority. Career officials panicked, and for good reason. Created by executive order in 1961, USAID could now then, of course, be dissolved with a single presidential signature. No congressional approval needed. No court challenges possible. Just one pen stroke and decades of carefully constructed financial networks would face the sunlight. And I have to interject here again. I didn't know USAID was not created by Congress. Nobody in USAID knew that they weren't created by an act of Congress, which would require an act of Congress to dismantle them. It was created by an executive order, all of which can be reversed, in 1961. Nobody knew that except the smart people that Trump had behind him digging for this stuff. As I said earlier, one of the senior officials warned watching Doge's algorithms crawl through now the USAID's databases. He said, pull this thread and a lot of sweaters will start unraveling. And boy, was he right. My goodness. Continuing here with quoting from the Override EKO newsletter. The resistance was immediate and telling. Career officials who had barely blinked at Treasury's exposure now work through weekends to block DOJ's access. And Democratic senators who had ignored other moves suddenly demanded emergency hearings. Former USAID officials flooded media outlets with warnings about, quote, institutional knowledge loss and diplomatic catastrophe, end quote. I need to insert something else here. Yeah, it is a catastrophe for USAID and for the mucky mucks that are paid a gazillion dollars to work for that bloated agency, which doesn't do anything except fund left-wing groups. No, it's not an institutional knowledge. It's maybe an institutional knowledge loss for USAID, but guess what? It's an institutional knowledge gain for the public, for this current administration. Yeah, diplomatic catastrophe for those who've sold out this country and have been working for the dark side all on our taxpayer dollars. But back to the piece. But their traditional defenses crumbled against DOJ's new playbook. While bureaucrats drafted memos about proper procedures, these young coders were already mapping payment flows. While senators scheduled hearings, pre-positioned personnel were implementing new transparency protocols. While media allies prepared hit pieces, DOJ's algorithms exposed decades of questionable transactions. This is just amazing. The scale was breathtaking. The Environmental Protection Agency climate initiatives not just mapped, they found unauthorized. These are these young guys, a half a dozen guys, super brainiacs, that know how to bust into our system that the people running the agencies can't figure out. They not just mapped the EPA's climate initiatives, they found unauthorized programs operating in 47 states. Education, Department of Education, actually it's the Department of Miseducation, or better yet, the Department of Indoctrination, the DEI maze, not just exposed, but these guys revealed coordination across 1,200 programs. And intelligence community black budgets, these are the ones you don't know about, not just were they traced, they uncovered patterns within the Department of Education and their black budgets, funding things that Congress never knew about. They uncovered patterns that have now been hidden for 30 years. You see, Department of Education is a disease. It's a parasite. It lives off you. It lives off me. How many thousands of dollars have I had to pay in taxes over my numerous years to pay for these slugs and these thugs and these crooks who take money from you and me? Back to the piece. A senior advisor explained, while he's watching these patterns emerge across DOJ's screens, he said, quote, the administrative state runs on two things. the control of information and the flow of money. We're not just exposing their networks. We are rewriting their DNA. And this official, this advisor is obviously not named, says his eyes were tracking new connections while he's watching the computer screens. These new connections forming or being disclosed in real time. They went on to say here that the cracks began showing in unexpected places. A career Environmental Protection Agency director, with tears streaming, says, quote, "Everything we built is being torn down." A USAID veteran with his hands shaking said, "They're inside all of it." A Treasury lifer closing his office says, quote, "They have moved faster than we can think." Wow. And across Washington, officials who had weathered every reform since Reagan began quietly updating their LinkedIn profiles. Oh, gee. A deputy director posts, quote, "Open to opportunities." An agency chief posts, quote, "Exploring new challenges." A bureau head posts, quote, "Time for change," end quote. DOJ's algorithms weren't just programs. They were archaeological tools, excavating decades of buried networks. Each data point connected to another. Each discovery revealed new targets. Each pattern exposing larger systems. One of the coders whispered, "It's beautiful." Watching the connections form across the screen, he said, "It's like watching a galaxy map itself," end quote. For the permanent bureaucracy, this wasn't change. It was an extinction-level event. You want to talk about an existential situation? I always talk about this is an existential threat, existential whatever. The Democrats, it's one of the few words that they use over and over and over that they, a few of them know what it means. But it's totally abused, misused, because Trump's the existential threat. Going into this databases, existential threat. Yeah, it's existential threat to these slugs, the Democrats, because we finally found out where the roaches are. We finally have a flashlight under the refrigerator and see these scumbags sucking up garbage that actually wasn't garbage. It was taken out of our refrigerator. It was good food once. We paid for it, and they eat it. Like watching a galaxy map unfold. Wow, all these connections. For the permanent bureaucracy, this wasn't just change. It is an extinction-level event. Their power came from controlling who got paid, when they got paid, and what they got paid for. Now these controls are evaporating like dawn, burning away darkness. The pattern has been devastating in its simplicity. Wow. Map the money flows, number one. Two, deploy aligned personnel. Three, expose the networks. Four, restructure the systems. By the time bureaucrats drafted objections to one breach, three more had already occurred, as I mentioned. But the revolution wasn't just spreading, it's accelerating. And all the people who hate Trump, why? For finding and exposing waste, fraud, abuse, corruption? If people are against waste, fraud, abuse, and corruption, guess what those people that are protesting are for? Waste, abuse, fraud, and corruption. Because they're part of it. They got all their little minions in the government offices doing their bidding. Every one side protects the other. Here's continuing with this, called the impact. The first bulldozer arrived in Springfield, Ohio at 6 a.m. on Tuesday. This is about 3 weeks ago. By noon, three blocks of notorious potholes were filled. Local news crews arrived to find not just construction crews, but data analysts there with laptops. So an extension of the DOJ brainiacs are on the scene in Springfield, Ohio, mapping every dollar spent against the real-time progress. This wasn't just road repair, it was a revolution in action. There was a woman who grabbed one of the analyst's arms with tears in her eyes. She said, 12 years, I've been writing and asking for these potholes to be filled for 12 years. And he turned his laptop to her. He showed the real-time data flows. He said, look, he said, here are your tax dollars now actually working. She stared at the screen. She said, oh, my God. Oh, my Lord, she whispered, it's really happening. Across America, funds once lost in administrative mazes are finding their way to actual problems that need solutions. The transformation is measurable. In just 2 weeks, tens of thousands of redundant programs have been identified, billions in waste exposed, hundreds of unauthorized initiatives halted, and countless local projects unleashed. I only read you one of them about the lady in tears after 12 years of wanting the potholes fixed in a nanosecond. These geniuses track the money flows and see that it's not going to the... It was allocated. It never got to the job. Scumbags were sucking it off. But the best thing to come out of this, the real metric, is that, as this article states, trust in government is rising for the first time in 50 years. The revolution has spread with surgical precision. Real-time tracking, how about that, is replacing quarterly reports. Algorithmic oversight is replacing review boards. Local solutions are replacing federal mandates, and results have replaced process. Vance again, quote, he, Trump, has done more in 2 weeks than Biden did in 4 years and Obama did in 8 years. He continues, but this isn't just about speed. This isn't just about tech. This isn't just about personnel. It's all three perfectly aligned. And for ordinary Americans, I'm done with the Vance quote, but for ordinary Americans, the impact was undeniable. Roads repaired, schools revitalized, water purified in Michigan, my home state, which they couldn't get done with a bureaucratic maze and a gazillion dollars and all Gretchen Whitmer, that bag, all she wants is more money. No, we just need to use the money that we have and which we have allocated and which my tax dollars and your tax dollars have provided. Continuing. But most importantly, something else was being restored, trust. For the first time in generations, people have seen their government not as an obstacle, but as a tool for positive change. The permanent bureaucracy has long operated on a simple assumption. Presidents come and go, but they remain. That assumption appears now shattered, replaced by a new reality that when preparation meets presidential determination, nothing is permanent. Vance continues, he said, quote, they thought we'd slow down, as he himself was studying real-time data flows across the agencies on these computers. They thought we'd get bogged down in the process. They thought we'd play by their rules. It goes on to say, Vance just smiled and said, no, instead, we're just getting started. How about that? So the sun rises in Washington early. But the day that this report came out, it said its first rays caught the classical columns of the Treasury building, casting long shadows across streets still quiet. But inside, beneath the marble and the granite, the screens of the coders still glowed blue because DOGE's algorithms never sleep. Senior advisor said the administrative state was built over decades. Watching these new patterns emerge across the displays, he continued to say, quote, but built to resist change, built to outlast presidents, built to preserve power. Then pausing as he watched another data flow, said, but they never imagined this. They built walls against political attacks, defenses against media exposure, shields against congressional oversight. They never prepared for algorithms that could map everything. For personnel pre-positioned everywhere, for a president who counts every week like it's his last. End quote. Thank you, Donald Trump. The numbers tell the story. In the Treasury, networks map waste exposed systems rewired at USAID. Decades of hidden flows revealed, power structures dismantled across various agencies, redundancies eliminated, authorities realigned, missions refocused. But even the numbers aren't the whole story. It says these changes are going to come to a community near you. Whether it's potholes in Springfield, Ohio, or rural Tennessee where children can finally connect to high-speed internet, or in Michigan where people truly now can drink clean water while bureaucrats' memos still talk about trying to study the problem, but memos that are now gaining dust. It isn't just reform. It isn't just change. This is American governance reimagined.
It's hard to say a month and a half into this, what's Trump's greatest accomplishment? There are so many.
Getting rid of the Department of Education. Oh, that's probably number one. And then I look at this. I said, no, this is number one. We've got no fifth place. We got about five things that are tied for first.
That's right. We do.
Now, I'm going to finish this program, though, with one cautionary thing for Mr. Trump that he's got to fix and he's got to quit. He's got to quit doing. I am not per se against the tariffs. But you can't have a tariff on Monday, change it on Tuesday, then reduce it, then double it on Wednesday, and then add other countries. And now just to this morning, throwing out about 200% tariff on wine from Europe. And now they're talking about, I realize that he uses tariffs as a club to bring people to the negotiating table. I actually don't have a problem with that. But don't change it every 48 hours. I mean, I will tell you, I'm getting absolutely creamed in the stock market. I am. And I have very few stocks because I'm not good at it. But I'm getting creamed, and it's because of the uncertainty. So my advice to Mr. Trump is tone the ego down and quit whipsawing. You want to whipsaw the enemies, the others, fine. But when the whipsaw then comes around like a boomerang, and we in different businesses, and I'm a small guy, really small, that can't figure out what to do. How are we going to price our inventory? Where do we ship to? Is the price we're selling at today, is that the price tomorrow? Are we going to, is the party going to cancel it because they're paying too much? Or are we going to take it in the shorts because of a tariff change, we mispriced it, and we're gonna eat it. You can't jump around like this, Donald. You can't. There's one thing the stock market hates. It's uncertainty. Uncertainty in times where it's demanded or expected, like war, is one thing. But not with almost seemingly whimsical changes in the tariff policy. You can't do it. I'm all for charging a tariff to another country equal to what that country charges us. But just don't change it on Monday and then on Wednesday and then Friday. You're going to cost us. It's going to cost us. I don't know that Marco Rubio can keep up with this. And I will probably have to lose more in the stock market, as will some others, many others, but not everybody. Most people in that area are smarter than I am. But maybe we just have to get slapped yet even further before he knocks it off and restores consistency. That's all it is consistency that's necessary. Now, I will say, I've given you my complaint and what he needs to do. And if he's on a power trip, he needs to knock it off. I love the guy. I love the White House briefings. He seems to be very humble.
But he doesn't have to speak and shoot from the hip all the time about, well, then we ought to raise this tariff or we ought to do that. Just make a game plan, but stick to it and don't change it. But I want to conclude this negative news with some great news. Right now, out of the 1,038 things that he's done right, this is the only one I disagree with. And so I would have to say in the end, nobody picks all winners, whether it's the stock market or owning real estate or what have you. If they say they do, they're lying. In the end, you would hope personally, from a financial standpoint, you simply have more winners than losers. And the blessing of God, you give faithfully, you bless Him, He blesses us, we'll have more winners than losers. And we get to use it faithfully. We've been blessed so that we can be a blessing. God bless you. Sit tall in the saddle, America. Remember, you ride for the brand of Jesus Christ, and we will see you next week.